Hey, I'm Andy Anatko, and I'm taking over Mac Break this week because both Leo and Alex are out. I've got John Gruber, I've got Chris Breen, I've got Jason Snell, and I've got Rich Siegel, titans of the Mac world, talking about titanic things that happened, including the reasons why Steve Jobs is being fitted for a Willy Wonka suit, this time on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
It's Mac Break Weekly, episode 297, recorded on May 1st, 2012. Mr. Jobs and the Great Glass Elevator.
Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain name registration and management that's simple. Upgrade to a premium domain and trade in your old clunkers at MacBreak.Hover.com. And by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to Audible.com/MacBreak.
It's time for Mac Break Weekly. I'm Andy Anatko, substituting for a traveling Leo Laporte and a traveling, or probably more likely just having traveled, now very much resting, Alex Lindsay. I really have lined up your basic concert for Bangladesh type lineup of all stars here for this week's show, starting with, on the double bass guitar, Mr. Jason Snell of Macworld. Jason, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Andy. Happy to be here. I'm in Petaluma, so nobody else showed up. Joke's on me. Here I am. Great to be here.
Yeah, we sent you on a Skype hunt there. And also on the double bass guitar, we have from Daring Fireball, John Gruber. John, long time no see.
Hey. Yeah, funny.
Yes.
Great to see you. And Jason, I'm very disappointed to find out that you're actually in the studio. I was hoping maybe you had recreated the studio in your house.
It's all a green screen. Actually, it's complicated. CGI involved.
I was gonna compliment you on the accuracy.
My home renovations the last 2 months have been to basically make the Twit studio in my house. My wife is mad because there's no kitchen anymore. But you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Now, Jason, is it more like Omega Man, where you're feeling like you're the last person on Earth, or is it more like Outland, where you feel like you're the only human inhabitant of a space station on a 5-year mission?
I'm going to say it's more like 2001 before they wake up all the people who are in cryogenic freeze. So it's just me and a mad computer, and you guys are the mad computer, I think. You're tormenting me with your... I don't have this many TVs at home.
Yeah, I was saying earlier that if you do want to, like, after this, like, record, like, an episode of the Macworld.com, like, video podcast, as if you're, you know, selling TVs here... You know, let's start looking at the Apple TV.
I got a deal for you.
Which size is going to be? What's the pluses? What's the minuses? I think you can cut a pretty good deal there. Also, on the double neck bass guitar, we're a very, very bass heavy concert today. Chris Breen, also from Macworld. Chris, how is ya?
I am well. I'm bass heavy today, and glad to be here.
Now, what's the album of today?
Oh, the album today because it's May
Day. You always have the album of the day.
Of course, the album of the day in the background, it is Firesign Theater's How Can You Be in Two Places at Once When You're Nowhere at All? And because it has Lennon and Marx on the cover, which, of course, John Lennon and Groucho Marx.
Excellent. I should have put this in the show notes. I assume that you would have prepared the Soviet national anthem. It is May Day, after all. So at appropriate time, please, again, stand up, face towards the east, and Hall Hail the slumbering heroes of the October Revolution. But you'll know the time when it comes up. I mean, you already know the lyrics.
You know, I was going to do that, but it turns out that the Chinese have purchased the rights to it now. And now under the new China, that if I were to do this, we would be sued out of existence.
Oh, God. Well, I feel like I wasted so much money because I had, like, you know, each one of you was drop-shipped, like, 50, like, Russian Navy choral member soldiers, so you can be in the background getting that sort of stirring sort of...
Unbroken chain of freeborn republics.
Sorry, that's all I know.
Союзные Рушими Республикс, Вьободникс, Флотила на веки Великая Русь.
I do know the rest of it.
I only do it in English, the original English.
See, that's why Soviet communism failed. You know, because they just could not get people on board. Lots of early adopters, but much like Google Plus, that just quickly kind of petered out.
They also just had a bad
on
song.
The double bass guitar, we have from BB Edit, sorry, barebonesoftware.com, Mr. Rich Siegel. Rich, you have your own chorus member right there too. Again, I don't. I'm sorry. I did order the soldiers online. It's possible that I clicked parrot instead of paratroop. It was a pop up, and I ordered it off my iPad.
Also, a toast to all of the glorious workers out there.
I, for one, welcome our avian overlords.
Through this. Oh wait, no, that's wrong.
Yeah, you don't want to put your lips on the wrong one, because what one will kill brain cells immediately, the other will kill brain cells after 5 or 10 years.
Happy May Day.
Yes.
It's great to see you all, even if it is rainy and miserable outside.
Well, it's rainy and miserable in the Soviet heart. That's how they get through that long Soviet winter and why they value such strong spirit. So let's go. We've got about 4 interesting topics. Well, unfortunately, we're going to talk about 8 different things. You'll get to pick at the end. Try to guess which are the interesting ones. You'll win a free hat or T-shirt, depending on sizes vary. I actually want to start off by talking about a conference that John and I just came home from, the UL conference. Rhymes with cool, as I was reminded. It took place for about 2 days in Dublin, Ireland last week. And was a really, really cool iOS developer conference, which was, I think, John, you'll agree with me. This has got to be one of the best run conferences I have ever been at. I'm sure you'd agree, too.
Oh, it was excellent. I mean, it was top notch. I mean, and both as from our perspective as speakers, and just talking to the attendees, I mean, it seemed like attendees were over the moon delighted with the way it went.
Yeah, I mean, every detail, all the way going down to I don't think I have it here, but the name tags that you were given, like when you registered, the tags kind of made me think that this is what Steve Jobs himself wanting to do like a little film festival for himself and 100 of his friends, and he was attending to every single detail himself, it would have worked out much the same way that that this conference worked out. The name badges were, oh, here it is. The name badges were, there you go. I don't know if you can see it, but beautifully designed, but also it's not like they were just printed in color, like on like laser print stock. It was like 3 kinds of textured paper, laser cut cutouts for the red flag at the top there, like embossed printing. And it was so good. You're like, I kind of want to wear this around day to day because it makes my name and my presence look very, very important.
Yeah, it seemed like the name tag seemed like something you wanted to keep in mint condition for future years selling on eBay. Like, you don't want to get that dented up. No, you know, don't wear it. That's what I thought. Don't.
Yeah, but it was a cool week, particularly because of the people that were there. There was a day's worth of workshops, then a day's worth of just sort of. It's not quite like a TED conference sort of series of talks, but shorter talks on broader sort of topics. It was really cool in that you'd have one person talking about one subject, and then 2 hours later, someone would be talking about something else that sort of contradicted the first guy a little bit. So it was a lot of discussion, a lot of open minds, a lot of open talk, and a lot of open pints of Guinness, which always helps out.
Yeah, and I have a friend, and I forget who I took this from, but I've been to a few other conferences with a similar schedule. The C4 conference, which Wolf Wrench, a Mac developer, used to hold in Chicago. The Singleton conference, which was in Montreal last October. All adhere to the same basic schedule, which, and I forget who I'm stealing this from, but somebody called it the wedding format, which is it kicks off Friday night. And in a wedding, that's like the rehearsal dinner. Then the conference proper is all day Saturday, like the wedding. And then Saturday night, everybody goes and the attendees stay together. Instead of dispersing at 5 o'clock, you all go to dinner together. Again, like a wedding. And then Sunday morning, there's just, or afternoon, there's a little, just in case you're still around in town, we can all eat together, break bread, have another Guinness or two, and head off to the airport. But that way, everybody gets to see each other Sunday, and you know, it's a nice way to say goodbye. And I thought it was, you know, I think that formula really works great for a small conference, especially these sort of single track, roughly 100, maybe 120 people. And it seems like you get to know everybody. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
It seemed very intimate. It seemed like I got to meet over half the people who were there.
Yeah, absolutely true. I mean, I came home with so many, like, you know, new email addresses of like, oh, hey, the next time you're in New England, come and visit me. Oh, next time you're in Chelsea, come and visit me. So all that sort of cool stuff. It seems as though that's where all the greatest conferences are now. We sort of moved away from as if we could still do like a 40, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 person conference like we could like 15 years ago. Now all the great conferences are things like Second Conf, where it's just a couple hundred people. At some point, you will basically meet pretty much everybody that's there, and you can really sit there and attend every single panel and every single class. And a lot of the good stuff does happen during the lunches, during the dinners, and just when you just cluster into small groups afterward. That's where a lot of the value is these days in modern shows. Also, there turned out to be sort of a minor Twitter competition to see who got the best shot of you giving the closing dinner speech. They held it at the Royal Hospital, which is about a 16 something building in this really, really church like cathedral type atmosphere. And John gave this really great talk that was so well received. And it seemed to be chiefly about why so many analysts seem to not want to admit that Apple is having a fairly good time of it, a fairly good year. I wonder if you could like sort of sum it up for Mac Break?
I will try to.
But
the main point is clearly Apple is on top of things right now. I mean, they're the biggest company by market cap in the world, not just in the tech industry, but period. Quarter after quarter, year after year, profits and unit sales for all of their flagship products are way up, with growth rates that are healthy for any company, but are sort of astounding for a company that is so literally large. And there have been other companies, you know, and everything works. But in the past, when other companies have sort of grown to the top spot in the pecking order, I don't recall seeing so much pessimism quarter after quarter, year after year from analysts and financial watchers. Like when Microsoft was the biggest company in the world, they'd announce, you know, their quarterly results, they'd have record-breaking profits. The day after that happened, you didn't see people saying, well, you know, look out for Lotus, they're ready to come back. Whereas a day or two after last week's Apple financials, there were people writing in the Wall Street Journal saying, well, good quarter for Apple, but I say short them. Motorola is coming out with new phones. And, you know, Motorola is coming out with new phones, and who knows, anything can happen. But it certainly doesn't seem very likely that Apple is going to lose the lead in profit and revenue from smartphones anytime in the next immediate future. The next year, maybe 2 years. But yet you see this with Apple every quarter after quarter, there's some contingent of analysts who you know, think the ship is ready to sink. And my best explanation for this is not really technical or analytical at all. I really think what it is a sort of psychological thing based on first impressions or early impressions. And it's that I just don't think humans are hooked up. We sort of make our first impressions. Whether it's a person, whether it's an organization, a store, anything we have a sort of relationship with, you make a first impression, you have a very short period of time to adjust it where it's liquid, where maybe you can very quickly decide, you know what, my first impression was wrong. This guy who I thought was great, he's an idiot. You know, you figure that out very, very quickly, but then it sort of cements and it's not going to move very much afterwards, no matter what happens. And I think that with Apple, a lot of people form their first impression, or at least their lasting impression, during those dry years. Let's just say the 90s, just to draw a rough period, where quarter after quarter, year after year, Apple sold about 1 million Macintosh computers a quarter, about 4 million of them a year, year after year, quarter after quarter. Sometimes a little less, those were the bad quarters. Sometimes a little more than 1 million, those were the good quarters. And that's not a bad business, selling 1 million $2,000, $3,000 personal computers a year, but there was no growth, and they were in an industry, the PC industry, that was growing tremendously during the 90s, which meant that Apple's overall market share was going down, 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 even though they were selling the same number of computers a year. And I think an awful lot of analysts form this opinion of Apple that they're a niche player and they're not really a long-term success in this era. And it doesn't matter what has happened since. And that was a long time ago. Doesn't matter what happens. They still have Apple filed away as the little guy who's going to get beaten by these other guys who do things very differently than the way Apple does. And so Jason, now I think, well, I just wanted to say one last thing I think it's important is that if you really just in broad terms want to understand Apple today, it's to think of things like the iPhone and the iPad as personal computers, and they sell for $600, $700, $800 each. And this past quarter, Apple sold 50 million of them total, if you add up iPhones, iPads, and Macs. So they're no longer the company that sells 1 million computers a quarter. They're a company that sells 50 million a quarter, and I don't know anybody who's going to bet that they're only going to sell 50 total next quarter. It's going to go up, up, up.
Jason, do you think is there anybody who when you think of analysts who actually play fair with Apple, who really judge them by the numbers that are actually there as opposed to the numbers that they hope they're going to see, is there any company, any analyst you think tends to get it right?
Wow, I don't keep an analyst scorecard. I mean, they come and go, yeah, and they really vary. I mean, like Michael Gartenberg gets Apple, and he understands, and you see him quoted a lot. You see on the analyst calls, you know, there are varying degrees of people. Like Sha Wu sometimes gets called and says reasonable things to CNBC. Horace Deju, obviously, who was at the UL conference, is an analyst, an independent analyst, who has some very perceptive things in terms of charts and graphs and numbers. But, you know, it varies. And a lot of these analysts, I agree with John, are thinking about Apple in a different way. And I'm not sure whether it's because Apple used to be that weird company that was always kind of an underdog selling niche products to a small audience, or whether it's just that they still can't accept that Apple does things differently than other people, and that's why Apple is successful, not a reason why they won't ultimately be successful, but that they're actually doing it right. Although I see the attitude is changing. I mean, people's attitude toward Apple the last 5 years, a lot of that stuff, I think, has fallen by the wayside. There are still those people out there, but I think there are fewer. I think in business in general, people look at Apple now and are starting to say, for the first time, you know, what we should learn what they're doing and understand why they're doing it, instead of just sort of waving it off and saying, oh, it's Apple, they do crazy stuff, we can't duplicate it, you just have to ignore them. So I think Apple's made progress, and how could they not in the last 5 years, given what's happened financially?
Yeah, the other weird thing about being a professional analyst is that you, by some measures, you do get to design the scorecard that you're going to be judging everybody else by. John made a really good point about it. What the scale and the scope of what Apple is depends on how you choose to define the word computer. If you certainly define it as any device that runs iOS, and that's a credible definition, Apple's just kicking butt up and down the schoolyard. If you choose to say, well, look, this is a phone and people don't really relate to it as a phone, then you could sort of tick off people that way. Then you could take a look at how people are actually using iPads and decide, well, who cares if it's a $500 device that has a really good operating system and runs really, really great software. If people aren't thinking about it as a computer, if it's not stealing sales away from like a $500 or $600 or $700 computer, then we can't judge it that way. So it really seems as though you get a different ref on the field who always tries to has a different idea of what the penalties should mean. The analyst call actually happened moments after we did Mac Break last week, so we can talk about it this week. As usual, it's the numbers that really encourage you to come up with new analogies for big, big numbers. $39.2 billion in quarterly revenue, net profit of $11.6 billion. Let's see, that was over $24.7 billion in net profit of $6 billion last time. 35.1 million iPhones in the quarter. This is the sort of these are the sort of numbers that really want somebody in jeans and a casual shirt in front of an enormous projected screen pacing back and forth, watching bars rise in the air. Let's go back to John. Is this a superiorly good quarter in a history of good quarters, or is it flattening off? How should we even start to process these numbers at an intellectual level above and beyond just simply, yeah, Apple got all the money last quarter, and they're probably going to get all the money next quarter too?
I think it's historically interesting. I think that you've got to think of Apple as almost like a new company in the iOS era. And again, going back to these first impressions, you know, the reason why I don't think that Google seems widely misunderstood or that Microsoft seems widely misunderstood is that where Google gets its money from, people understood very quickly from before their IPO that they have the best search engine. Everybody uses it. Everybody does lots of searches, and there's an easy way for them. Well, I say easy, but they have a repeatable way of getting a couple of pennies from people every time they do a search because of the ads they show. Everybody understood it. Everybody could see how that was going to make an awful lot of money, and they understood it. I think you've got to look at Apple just in the iOS era and just see the growth in iPhones and iPads year after year, quarter after quarter. I mean, to me, the two most astounding numbers last quarter, from the last week's numbers, are that the iPhone had 88% year-over-year growth. And that's, you know, no longer really a new product. I mean, that was 5 years ago when it was announced. So 5 years after it was announced, it's still growing 88% year-over-year. And the iPad grew 151% in unit sales year over year, which is ahead. Now, that was announced 2 years ago initially. 151% growth and just under 12 million units is way ahead of where the iPhone was 2 years after it debuted. So if that keeps up, I mean, and you know, there's no guarantee that it will, but if the iPad continues on the trajectory where it is, it's accelerating faster than the iPhone was, which I think is just tremendous in terms of building a multi-legged, you know, the old analogy about you want your business stool to have a more than one or two legs. Boy, that's the iPhone and iPad are two really, really good legs to have.
Yeah, one of the great quotes from Tim was, to put in context, was just 2 years after we shipped the initial iPad, we've sold 67 million. To put that in some context, it took us 24 years to sell that many Macs and five years for that many iPods, 3 years for that many iPhones. So there's an incredible acceleration in people adopting the iPad. But is this maybe one of the reasons why some analysts are starting to get a little bit cautious about Apple? I mean, at some point, the space shuttle takes off the pad and it gets incredible acceleration, but at some point those boosters fall off and now it becomes a Newtonian object. Like, Jason, anytime when you see these numbers, when you see growth that approaches 100% every single quarter, do you start to worry that this is the time to get prepared for the first time when Apple can, God forbid, actually make enough iPads to satisfy demand and they're not sold out every single week?
I think it's out there, but I think it's still a little far away. I think it's a little bit like saying, well, you know, everybody dies, so prepare for the end. I mean, it may not happen tomorrow. It will happen inevitably.
there is the heat death of the universe to consider.
Exactly, always. Right. The universe will end at some point. But, you know, I don't know. The iPhone, you look at that, I think maybe a year or two ago we might have looked at the iPhone sales growth and said, well, they can't keep that up. But what's happened is they've gone into other markets and they've lowered the prices on the products. And you're seeing amazing growth on the iPhone in China right now, for example. And then the iPad, you're talking about a product that's really creating a new product category. They haven't sold that many of them. There's a huge market for people who have never bought a tablet computer before, who have never even thought about it before, as that product grows. So, yeah, I mean, you keep thinking it's inevitable that these things are going to cool off, like the iPad, I mean, like the iPod cooled off. But the iPhone, it may cool off in North America and Europe a little bit, but it's got other countries and other regions that are picking up the slack. And then the iPad is right behind it, accelerating even faster because it's got more potential market. So I think that these are rockets that are not going to run out of fuel for a while, which isn't to say that Apple doesn't need to be thinking about what's next. But I do think that there's room for even more insane growth from Apple in the next few years.
Chris, do you think that the time is coming when during an upcoming keynote, Tim Cook has to haul out the old line they've been using about Apple TV? He said, well, we consider macOS to be a hobby for us. We don't reveal the numbers on how many copies that we actually sell. In the analyst call, sales of macOS devices were also very, very good and very, very strong, nowhere near as meteoric as we were seeing in iOS. It really does seem like the acceleration of iOS is outpacing macOS by considerable margin. Do you think that means that iOS is going to be the the signature, the Tiffany brand for Apple and macOS is just going to be something that they continue to sell and continue to work in because we have all this money from iOS. It doesn't matter how well we do with macOS.
No, because the Macs and the macOS are still necessary parts, even if only to support iOS. You still need a computer to do a lot of things with your iOS devices. Plus, there's a lot of work that can't be done on an iOS device that if you're doing serious video editing, if you're doing even some page layout stuff, that, I mean, kind of all the typical markets that the Mac has always dominated in will continue to do so. Because as lovely as these devices are, they're not yet to the point where you're going to be able to do professional kinds of work. They don't have enough power to do that kind of thing. So, no, I don't think so. I think that, yes, this is the sexy product right now and will continue to be, as are other iOS devices, and they'll continue to have great numbers. But I think macOS will continue to be a bedrock product line for Apple. Certainly, their laptop sales have grown a lot in the last couple of years. And we're seeing people that have purchased an iOS device for, and now they're looking back at getting a Mac laptop, a MacBook Air, for example, because they understand that all they've heard about Apple is that this stuff is easy to use, we like the way it's designed, is now starting to fall back toward the Mac again. So I think you're going to continue to see great support for the Mac OS.
Yeah, there was an analyst report that came out a few days ago suggesting that for 25% of iPad purchasers, this is their first Apple device they've ever bought. So it's kind of maybe it's working sort of as a gateway drug. But what kind of concerns me is that Apple has had really great success in limiting the amount of power that they put into computers and devices. And that's sort of a biased way of saying that they want devices and software that works all the time, that works well with everything else. And sometimes to make that goal happen, you have to simply say, no, the user is not allowed to do whatever they want to do. My concern is that by the time we see not 10.8, but 10.9, by the time we see 11, Apple might feel as though they've had enough votes from enough of their users to say that it's okay for us to create an OS that maybe is not powerful enough to do professional level video editing, not powerful enough to do professional page layout. We're willing to give that small, single digit percentage of the market back to Windows so long as we can focus on the stuff that we really like to do. Does that make any sense to anybody?
I don't know. I mean, if you look at the Mac, it's 13% of Apple's revenue, which seems really small. And I've had a lot of people say to me, well, this means that Apple is going to get rid of the Mac and it's all going to be iOS. Yep. But you look at what the Mac can do. To Chris's point, the iOS devices can't do that yet. Tim Cook made this statement about somebody asked him about fusing a MacBook Air with an iPad, and Tim Cook said that was a little bit like making a toaster refrigerator combination.
Yeah.
And you know, his point there is that laptops are good for some things and tablets are good for other things. And you know, we can debate the toaster fridge thing because the convergence may happen. But I think the Mac as a product line, if you look at it on its own, it's growing. I think something like 15 out of the last 20 quarters, they've set a record for the most Macs sold. This was not a holiday quarter, so they didn't. But generally, the Mac is doing better than ever. Its record Mac sales are happening. About half the Mac buyers in Apple stores have never bought a Mac before, so they're pretty much picking up market share from Windows. And so you put all of that together, and I think it's a rosy future for the Mac, at least for a while. Again, you can never say never, but it's a successful business. It's just a smaller part of Apple's whole. I don't see Apple walking away from it just because, even though it's the only part of the PC industry that's growing, and it's growing a lot, and it's setting records, it's, you know, 13%, that's not important to us. And I do think that Apple makes a lot of money off of the Mac, and that there are benefits to having a personal computer in Apple's ecosystem. So, you know, I'm skeptical about the Mac's demise. I think that it's going to be around, but to use that Steve Jobs metaphor, you know, it's very clearly becoming more like a truck, where it's the device you use for very certain tasks. And, you know, that's how I use it. I edit podcasts using GarageBand on my Mac, and I write long articles on my Mac, but almost everything else I do, I really do on my iPad now. So that's the direction it's going. I just don't think we're going to be there for a little while.
I certainly don't think that Apple will ever discontinue Mac OS. My worry is that if they list the 100 things that a Mac can do right now, and they think, well, if we reduce that list to 80, we can make this 50% easier, 50% faster, 50% greater value to the user. I think that would be inside Apple. I think that'd be a very compelling argument. But you also brought up another really great quote from Tim Cook about the toaster fridge, and Microsoft PR basically had react on Twitter saying pretty good-naturedly, yeah, well, maybe we're not building a toaster fridge, we're building a toaster oven, and those tend to be kind of popular. I think that was the one thing from the call that kind of made me sort of like rewind and play that back a little bit, because I've talked about this before on other podcasts, that when you use I'm not convinced that the idea of having a really good mobile operating system that also runs desktops, that also sits side by side with the desktop operating system, is a really bad idea. Every single time that I travel with a MacBook and an iPad, I feel like that was kind of a failure, because I want that device on the plane that I can read books on, and that's I can actually use on the 8-inch interface sort of experience. But then I want to be able to hook up a keyboard to it and actually use it as a regular desktop computer. And we can't really lose sight of the fact that the iPad is still a $500 thing. $399 if you buy the iPad 2, but if you buy a really good new iPad, now you're up to $800 or $900. So that's why I'm not predicting anything for Windows 8, but I'm really curious to see in 2013 how consumers are going to react to the idea of a $900 Intel-based Windows 8 desktop slate that can also run nice mobile apps. Are they going to see it as this is kind of a really chunky, really fat, really heavy, really hot running, really low battery performing version of the iPad? Or are they going to say, well, I can get this device that is the laptop that I needed to get anyway, and also I don't have to buy this $500 iPad because I can also use it as the kid's tablet drawing device. I can use it as my e-reader. I think that there's going to be a lot of votes coming from a lot of different sources to see whether that's going to work out for people or not.
Well, I mean, lots of people have a toaster oven, it's true, but I would wager more people have a toaster in an oven than just a toaster oven. But this goes back to Apple focusing on specific markets, especially at the start. And, you know, it's the same reason Apple only has a 10-inch tablet and a phone right now. They don't have a 5-inch or a 7-inch device right now. They went for the sweet spots, and I think maybe right now the toaster oven is not a sweet spot for them. It's not to say that it might be, and I think if the Windows 8 stuff is successful, then maybe it is. I think it's definitely true that Apple wants the iOS devices to be as productive as possible, and it's not Apple's goal to kind of keep productivity out of iOS in order to save Mac sales. They're definitely not going down that path.
I'm not talking about saving Mac sales. I'm talking about more about their feeling that as a philosophy that, well, why should there be a backseat in the car? People don't use the backseat in the car except to put their trash back there. Sometimes I think they have a philosophy that's not 100% in sync with the marketplace. And I think that I do think we're going to see some interesting information coming in 2013 about once we have our first real competitors to the iPad. We haven't had one yet. We've had many, many failures competing to the iPad. I'm waiting for the first thing that costs roughly the same as an iPad, has a decent amount of apps for it, or at least a credible amount of apps for it. And I really want to see what happens the first time the consumers get to see one of these side by side and say, which one of these two things do you want? We want competition more than anything else. Let's just move on just for a sec, because we have to cut to Leo Laporte, who has an incredibly important message from the hovering spacecraft that he is vacationing in right now. Leo?
Thank you, Mr. Anatko. How many times, show of hands, has this happened? You're watching a show like this and you go, hey, I got a great idea for a domain name. And you run over to your registrar, I hope it's hover.com, and you register the domain name. Now, if it is hover.com, there's good news here, because they let you trade in those domain names you've never used. How many do you own that you've never used? Those, we call them clunker domains. They will let you trade in the clunker domain for a premium domain, and they will refund everything you spent at hover.com, including registration and renewal fees. So now, go ahead, register domain names as much as you want, because if you never use them, you can get your money back. That's just one of the many reasons I love hover.com. They've got a domain transfer service. I recommend you use it. Tell them I sent you, and I think it's $25, but I think they'll rebate you that service fee for that. But it is also $10, and they will not rebate you. It is $10 for each domain you're transferring to Hover.com. But with that $10, you get a whole nother year. So it's actually a very good deal. $10, you get an additional year, and you get all the great domain registration and management stuff that Hover does. First of all, a simple, clean interface. Go look at it. Go to MacBreak.Hover.com. The domain management stuff is so clean. There's none of this extra click, buy this, buy this, buy this. No. You get domain privacy as part of the deal. It's just built in. And they've got these premium domains. It's kind of interesting. If you're trying to register a domain name somebody already has, look for the gold stars next to those names. Those are domains that somebody owns, and they've set a price. Just like you pay, you know, it's like the buy it now price. You pay it, it's yours, no haggling, and they're not going to jack the price up when they find out it's you that wants to buy it. I think that's pretty good. So clunker trade-ins, premium domains, a no-hold customer service policy means once you get through Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern, you will not be put on hold. Your problem will be solved. Just the best domain service. I talk to people all the time who've moved to Hover and are so happy. I want you to do it too. MacBreak.Hover.com. All right, all right. You want a special offer? I'll give you a special offer. Use the offer code MacBreak. You'll get 10% off your domains. 10% off your domains. That does not include the premium domains, of course. MacBreak.Hover.com. Thank you, Andy. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Leo. From the helicarrier, the new Twit helicarrier, hovering in an undisclosed location. I'm told it's over one of the two poles. So by all means, guess which one you'd like. Again, it's another T-shirt giveaway. Guess which pole the Twit helicarrier is hovering over for that free T-shirt. Be sure we get your size and whether you're allergic to cotton, because it's not really cotton. We outsourced it. We got a good deal, is really all we want to talk about. The other really cool, really good news from last week was tickets for WWDC 2012 finally went on sale. They were also, Apple was also nice enough to actually tell people when it would be taking place. It's going to be taking place in San Francisco from June 11th to June 15th. The tickets, 5,000 tickets went on sale and were completely sold out within 2 hours. So, Rich, you are not a new person in the field of Mac software development. You're not going to WWDC this year, are you?
No, as it happens, I had previously made vacation plans, and I'm going to be enjoying a lovely week somewhere else during WWDC. This happened last year, too, although the time period between the announcement of tickets on sale and the announcement of we're out of tickets was slightly less dramatically short. But the tickets still sold out in about half a day last year. And it's a little astonishing when something like this happens. But I got to tell you, I don't think it's all that uncommon. You know, Google I/O sells out very quickly. Many of these wedding conferences, these weekend wedding conferences that John was talking about, very limited attendance, but they too sell out very quickly. It's a good thing for Apple because it increases the perceived value of the conference. I mean, something that sells out that fast must be something that millions of people want to go to. On the other hand, it can be exasperating if you're somebody who woke up, if you live in California or Hawaii or really any place between New York City and the international dateline and discover, oh, I missed my opportunity. How nice. And there have been some discussions of the issue. My take on it is sort of in an overarching way is that, you know, it is Apple's show. It is their game and they can run it however they like. I think if I were supervising the effort, I might suggest doing a ticket lottery so that registered developers have the opportunity to buy a ticket if they win, in quotes, the lottery. I once had the fortune many, many years ago to win a Red Sox ticket lottery, which got me the opportunity to buy tickets on top of the Green Monster. And it's a great way to do it when you've got limited slots and a lot of demand. You know, people can be disappointed when they don't win the lottery, but on the other hand, they can't complain that there's a bias. And I've heard a lot of that this year about WWDC tickets. Oh, you know, there was a bias towards people in early time zones. There's a bias against people in California. It's like, no, it's just the system. I don't think anybody said, ha, 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 let's screw people in California. I'm pretty sure that didn't happen. There have been some administrative screw-ups. There's been discussion of developers who bought tickets, multiple tickets for folks in the company, and they had their tickets canceled because more than one ticket was bought on a single credit card. I'm glad I didn't run into that, but I know some folks who did, and that's pretty exasperating too. But I think that's just a simple administrative screw up as well, and hopefully that'll get all sorted out quickly. I think in the larger picture, though, the developers conference does remain extremely important. You know, if you want to get early access to what's coming up, if you want face-to-face access to not only engineers at Apple, but also the developer relations representatives who are there, your peers, the term that comes up frequently at tech conferences is the so-called hallway track. And those are, you know, it refers to the whole concept of just randomly running into people in the hallways between sessions and just having these great impromptu conversations. You can build lasting relationships. You can have brilliant brain flashes, and the value of that really can't be understated.
How important is it for developers to actually get into that conference? To actually get passes to that conference? Are they? Do you think are the developers out there who feel as though we will not be able to ship our product on time unless we get access to the information and the sessions that are going to be there live for this week? We can't afford to wait for it to hit video.
I don't think so. The developers conference to me has always been more of a strategic conference. It's never really been a tactical. It's never really been a matter of tactical importance. You know, I'm sure that there are going to be some edge cases. There are going to be some folks who say, well, I was really hoping I could get in to talk to somebody in person that week. But honestly, Apple Developer Services has compatibility labs. You can get excellent help from developer tech support. And you can make arrangements to actually go to the Apple campus. So I don't really see that argument as holding a lot of water. But yeah, the developers conference is more strategic. It's where you learn under non-disclosure what Apple has planned really for the next year. It's where you can get good in-depth instruction on stuff that's already shipping. So, of course, those parts aren't confidential. But you can sit in a session for an hour or an hour and a half and hear firsthand from the engineers who wrote a particular part of the OS and hear them talk about how it works and how to use it effectively and how to get the most of it. But that really is strategic, not so much.
Well, I was wondering if it's, and I was going to ask you, Rich, if it's worthwhile for people who didn't get tickets to go anyway and kind of sit outside Moscone somewhere, find a hall, and still have the opportunity to speak with their peers.
The ability to do that, I suspect, is going to be limited. The geography of it's an interesting question. Certainly the geography of Moscone itself and the way the conference is laid out makes it a little bit tricky. There's a big entrance hall, and I suspect that Apple security, who oversees the on-site security that week, is going to not be real tolerant of people just sort of randomly camping out there without badges and on the sidewalks.
I wasn't suggesting you could
certainly go to San Francisco that week
and where you're Hockenberry disguise.
That's right.
Oh, you're the 11th grade Hockenberry we've had registered today.
Here's my Hockenberry disguise, giant fleshy palm.
Yes.
Height up.
But to speak to the slightly less literal interpretation of the question, though, I think you could you could reasonably travel to San Francisco that week and, you know, let your friends who were going to the conference know that you were going to be there that week. And I think there may be some people from the greater area who are going to do that. I can't say that it's a bad idea. I can't really say that it's a good idea. I don't think I would do it if I weren't already going on vacation. That's sort of going to be a matter of individual preference.
Mm-hmm. Wow, Indianatco's Skype has died.
Oh dear,
yeah, after a short illness.
Let's call the congregation together again, and all say together, join hands and say, Skype is a worthless piece of junk.
Amen.
We only use it because we are forced to use it by its mere popularity. If we could sit and watch it die, we would watch it die without feeling an ounce of emotion one way or another. Amen. And now let's continue with Mac Break. Thank you. I'm sorry I needed to get that out of my system. But I wanted to, on that point of like not actually attending the sessions at WWDC, but still thinking that's sort of important, we have a bunch of people, two of whom can actually go to the area of WWDC and see if Apple does a media event the first day, they can go to that for essentially the cost of city parking. John and I will have to pay a bit more than that to fly out to San Francisco, but I assume that all of us are going to go to San Francisco to be in town for this week.
Oh, yeah.
John, are you flying out?
Yeah, I'll be there.
Yeah. So what do you expect to get by having boots on the ground for that week?
Well, I go because the primary reason I go is it's the best way to meet other people in the industry face to face, and there's no better way to build trust and I'm not even talking about getting inside information or anything like that. It just is, you know, there's an awful lot of people who I consider to be good sources or people who I can just throw a fact to and say, hey, am I insane? Here's the angle I'm sort of taking on this piece, but am I nuts to write this? But I know that it's right up their alley and they can just say, send back to me. Yeah. You know what? I think you have a good point there. Or no, I think, you know, I think you're off base. I have a lot more people who I can send those things to who I've met face to face than people who I haven't met face to face. And, you know, that's by far and away, especially now that Apple itself has pulled out of all, you know, things like, you know, Macworld Expo in the summer went away almost or maybe more than a decade ago. I actually forget. But now that they've pulled out of Macworld in San Francisco, it's really the only chance you get to meet people who actually work at Apple face to face. So for me, it's worth it just to build, you know, I hate to use the term, but just for networking purposes.
Yeah, there's definitely that. If you go out to breakfast at Mel's Diner, you will essentially see the authors of pretty much every app that you ever care to use ever, all having $10 omelets around you. Jason, your life is going to be pretty much centered around Moscone Center that week, yeah?
Yeah, it's easier for me because, you know, I take the bus. I don't even have to pay for the city parking. It's four blocks away from my office. But it's incredibly valuable. It's a great week because all the developers are there. These little conferences, like the one you and John went to, are great. I love those conferences. But WWDC is different in that almost everybody, with the exception of Rich this year, who is an Apple developer, is there, and all the people from Apple are there. And basically all the people from the media are there because Monday they invite the media to the keynote. And so it is the definitive event for Apple because you don't have at an Apple media event, only the media and analysts are there, and some people from Apple, but the developers aren't there at those. And at Macworld Expo, you'll get a lot of developers there and you'll get some media there, but you don't get Apple there. So this is the big social event, really. And I would be very sad if it didn't exist. It really needs to be there. It's a vital part of the Apple world because everybody who's anybody really is at WWDC.
No. As members of the August media, are we expecting big announcements for WWDC? It used to be just like clockwork. You could expect the big iOS announcement for the iPhone platform to happen in June or July. Now that's not quite so reliable anymore. What are we thinking we're going to be hearing if they do a media event day?
Well, it's a developers conference, right? And I think Apple's been pretty good at making it primarily a developer message. and focusing the whatever big announcements they've got on things that are also relevant to developers, which is why it's probably going to be at least primarily OS announcements. You know, we've had the pre-announcement of Mountain Lion. I expect that we'll have more detail about what's going to happen with the release of Mountain Lion. You know, when is that going to happen? How far along are they? And usually once a year we get an iOS announcement. It would be iOS 6 now. And I would imagine we'll get a lot of detail about what that next wave of iOS is going to be too. And maybe there'll be some hardware announcements there, but I don't think they're necessary. I think that the OSs, which are the things that the developers really care about, generally are going to be the backbone of any kind of media event that would happen.
Do you think the developers are generally happy this year, or are they going there with a certain sense of expectation that some of their problems are going to get solved? I don't think there's a mutiny rising, but I've 2011 and early 2012 has marked, in terms of talking with the developer friends, more angst, more agita, more. I really hope that they post a document at some point, someplace, explaining what the heck I'm supposed to be doing with this feature that they told a million billion people around the world my app was supposed to support in 3 months' time, but I have no idea how it's going to support it. Like, I don't expect they're going to come up. They're going to be showing up wearing Guy Fawkes masks or anything like that. But there seems to be some grumbling in the air. I mean, is anybody else hearing that?
I don't know. I mean, I think they always grumble, but this is when you smooth things out with developers, right?
Yeah, developers love to complain, right? You know, there's always something to complain about. You complain about your tools. You complain about the OS. You can complain about the policy. I think if you I think the big S word is going to be on everybody's lips at this developers conference. The other S word, sandboxing. Because, of course, that is something that sort of publicly or semi-publicly has been kicked around a lot. Apple announced this at the developers conference in 2011, and they said, okay, by the beginning of November, you need to be sandboxed. And then they kicked that deadline down the road a little bit, and it became March, and then March came, and it didn't happen, and it became June. Now, you know, Apple's way of doing things sometimes involves saying, this is how we're going to do it. And then everybody either comes along or pushes back. And, you know, pushing back is as important a part of the process as coming along. And if developers push back, Apple says, okay, let's adjust and keep moving forward. And I think we'll see. I think we've seen some of that. And I think that the deadline changes for sandboxing are the result of that. I believe there have also been technical changes as the result of developer feedback. And I think we're going to see that continue to evolve. In particular, because sandboxing is a very tricky and complicated issue. You talk about trucks before. Well, you know, if you're a truck, sandboxing presents a pretty serious issue. So there are a lot of unanswered questions. There are a lot of answered questions. And I think that Apple's going to be listening pretty carefully. They're going to need to listen pretty carefully and keep adjusting. I myself am curious to see what happens when June rolls around as far as sandboxing goes. As far as announcements go, you know, one thing that John touched on was the Macworld Expo and Apple having pulled out of it. I see the WWDC keynote, the public keynote, taking the place of the old Macworld Expo in Boston when it comes to Apple's summertime announcements. So, sure, not only, as Jason said, will they announce things that are relevant to developers, OS announcements, yes. I bet we could see a hardware announcement. We have seen summertime hardware announcements. We might also see things that pertain to back to school, although it's a little bit early for that. You know, I think the picture is pretty wide open for what we could see happening in June. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants a new Mac Pro, and it's May. You know, could they wait until June to announce something? They might.
Yeah, well, I already have there's a embossed number card in my wallet with a randomly generated number that I generated exactly 2.5 months ago that the whatever number this is, that nth person to ask me about an Apple television set will get both a $20 gift card to Dunkin' Donuts and a punch right in the gut. I'm really looking forward to like never having to answer that question again. I now want them just to get like, you know when you go to a waterbed store and they give you a free TV just for coming in and getting a sales pitch, if they just simply buy one of those like off brand Lutonian manufactured TVs and put an Apple logo on it, that will solve all of our problems just by removing it as a topic of conversation. So we're not going to know what they're going to be announcing in June until June, but hopefully we'll have something less to talk about after that happens. Two absolutely ridiculous stories. I'm sorry, you were about to say?
Well, I just had one thing to add on WWDC,
sure,
which is that there's an old saying that when somebody comes into a lot of money and people say, well, he really changed after he had success. I tend to think that it's not so much that people change when they have success. It's that their true selves come out. It's that when you don't have to answer to anybody else, the more independent you are, the freer you are to just sort of be yourself. And I think you see that with companies too. And now that Apple is successful, I tend to think Apple is becoming more and more Apple-y. And part of Apple's nature is to be a little insular and to work on things in private and then release them and just say, here's how they are. And in some ways, that doesn't work with developers, with third-party developers, where they need to get them on board. And I'll just two quick examples. One, what Rich said, sandboxing, which they sort of sprung on everybody last year. And clearly, in both in the immediate, like the first day after they announced it and what people were saying in the hallways, and now, you know, 10 months later, after they've missed three deadlines, it's very clear that there were an awful lot of cases, not even edge cases, like very common cases that Apple either didn't consider or just overlooked. And I'll also say with the whole iCloud storage, which is clearly, I mean, they announced it as a primary focus for the company for the next 10 years of that, you know, that's the new hub is iCloud. Well, I don't think we're nearly as far towards using iCloud as our storage for our lots and lots of stuff as Apple made it seem we'd be 10 months later a year ago. And I think a lot of that is that Apple doesn't do that well at the dance of here's what we want to do as Apple. Let us listen to what you need, developers, the people writing all these apps. What do you need from this? The back and forth happens very, very slowly. And so that's the thing that I'll keep my eye on at the keynote is how much have they reacted to the feedback they've gotten on those two things in the last year, and they have gotten an awful lot of feedback.
Yeah, that's for damn sure.
But do you think that's going to change at all because with Tim Cook in charge versus Jobs? Because I know that I understand what you're saying, that Apple becomes more Apple-y, but is that attitude changing a little bit in that Tim Cook has sort of signaled there's going to be a kinder, gentler Apple without, you know, completely opening up the kimono?
I think that's very possible. And I think that's definitely something that for us who like to read into every single thing they say and what they don't say, definitely something to keep an eye on going forward. And this will certainly be the first year, obviously, where the keynote is, you know, the WWDC keynote is not influenced directly by Steve Jobs.
Yeah, this is the first post-Jobs true Tim Cook in control message to developers. So that's going to be another high water mark to see if that attitude sort of changes.
All right. How much of it is back and forth, and how much of it is Apple coming down the mountain with this year's directives written on stone tablets? You know, here's what you're going to do this year.
Yeah. Also, I mean, Apple has been spanked several times before. I mean, we forget the initial debacle about the iPhone's original price, where they thought they could charge about as much for a phone as for a laptop. And what was it, 6 weeks later that they said, okay, just kidding about that original price. Of course, we're only going to be charging you $299, which is pretty much what everyone else is charging for a smartphone. So do they listen, or do they just realize that we're getting hit a lot in very soft places of our body? We don't want to get hit anymore. And so we regretfully acknowledge that we have to sort of react to what how people are perceiving our decisions.
Both of those things happen, I think. You know, I think sometimes it's Apple responds because there's a crisis and Apple needs to be seen as reacting to it. And then other times it is Apple listening. And I think with a lot of developer stuff, there are cases where Apple's really pushing something that it feels is the right thing to do. And it's going to say, yeah, I know you guys don't like it, but this is the right thing to do. Other times, though, I think that there's internal strife at Apple and somebody wins and that's what gets announced. And everybody who disagreed with it is waiting to hear the developers say, wait a second, that doesn't make sense for all of these reasons. At which point those other people inside Apple can say, see, this is a problem. And then there's an internal debate about it. And I do think that happens. And I think that what Rich said about the evolution of the sandboxing issue is a great example of that, where Apple, you know, they... You know, Apple tends to like the Apple's very comfortable making pronouncements saying this is how it's going to be. But it does listen and it does evolve. It's got a little more pride than to accept and talk about that openly. But it is happening with things like sandboxing. So I think we'll see a little bit of both. Right. We'll see some pronouncements and we'll see some evolution of Apple's past claims. And to John's point, I really hope that Apple treats their developers with some of that, like, here's what we'd like you to do. It's always a better message to say, here's what we'd like you to do, rather than here's what you will do for this next year. But they're capable of it.
Here's how it's going
to be. Yeah, yeah, they're capable of it.
Well, there are two semi-ridiculous stories that cross the wires last week. One is the absolute shock and scandal that Apple as a company might try to use legal means to pay somewhat less taxes than they might otherwise have to. As you can see, I have not been able to feed, bathe, or clothe myself ever since I heard this news. I've been in the field position underneath that table over there.
I am shocked.
Does anybody think this is an issue? Yeah, it's more of the junior high school clique sort of dynamic at play that's more interesting. This story initially was put out by New York Times, which already is getting some heat over all their coverage about Apple's labor practices. And then Forbes came out with an article after the New York Times scandalous piece about the tax situation saying, yeah, you know what? You're basic. When you said how little percentage of Apple's income they pay in taxes, you're basically basing their current profits off the estimated taxes that they made 2 years, a year or two ago before they had all these earnings. And so your estimates are way, way, way out of whack. So there's a lot of TMZ.com style, well, he said and then she said, but you won't believe what the New York Times said after she heard. But is this any kind of a story? Does anybody have an opinion on this?
Well, it's a story, but it's not a story about Apple, right?
Yeah.
It's a story about
companies don't
taxes
like
and regulation. And, you know, companies, public companies have a financial duty to their shareholders to make as much money as possible. And that includes using all existing laws in order to make as much money and pay as little in taxes. So this is a little like those stories about millionaires saying, you should tax me more. And then other people coming out and saying, why don't you just write a big check? The whole point is, if I don't have to pay you money, I won't. So you should make everybody have to pay. And that's why this story is a tax reform story more than anything else. Because, you know, Apple's never going to just donate money to the government out of the goodness of his heart, just like no other public company is going to do that. So, you know, Apple's a great example because they're riding high. But this is a tax reform story, not an Apple story.
Yeah,
I think
Apple... During the Cupertino City Council meeting in which Steve Jobs came and presented the idea for the new Apple campus, there's that famous quote where a city councilman was sort of hopefully saying, yeah, well, we were wondering, like, since you're putting all this money into your building, maybe you could also give us, like, free Wi-Fi for the whole city. And then Steve just smiled and said, yeah, well, our philosophy is that we pay you a huge amount of money in taxes and that you can then use to go buy your own Wi-Fi. So I think that's pretty much the Apple attitude towards taxation in a nutshell. I mean, but you're right, Jason. I mean, if you lay two pairs of shoes in front of somebody, one is a tight, uncomfortable pair of shoes, and the others are a pair of Uggs that are loose, warm, and comfortable. Yeah, they're probably going to choose the ones that hurt less to actually use. I think that seems like an actually correct thing. One, the other story that was kind of more interesting comes from a book by Ken Segal coming out called "Insanely Simple: The Obsession That Drives Apple's Success." A story which he claims is well sourced said that during Apple's comeback, when they were shipping new iMacs, Steve Jobs had this idea where he wanted to include a Willy Wonka style golden ticket inside the 1 millionth Mac that they shipped. And that if you bought an iMac and opened it and got the golden ticket, Steve Jobs would come. We would come to Cupertino. Steve Jobs. This is the part where I had to read three times to see if it was actually sourced. It was, apparently. He wanted to show up dressed like Willy Wonka in a top hat and tails and take you on a tour of the Apple campus. And supposedly the only factory. Reason the major reason why Steve got talked out of this was because California law says that they couldn't do a sweepstakes that required the purchase of an iMac, and if not for that, there would be somewhere hanging in some closet a mock turtleneck version of Gene Wilder's costume from Willy Wonka. I want everybody's take on this. I also want to know that if Slugworth were to pursue each of these winners, what device would they want this person to steal off the Apple campus, and what absolutely amusing fate would befall each of them by Apple's own Oompa Loompas? And I'm going to start with you, Jason.
Could you repeat the question? You're breaking up. Your Skype is killing. Oompa Loompas? Yeah, about Oompa Loompas. Yes, I'm in favor of them. They're orange. Yes.
I'm not crazy about the color, though. It's not a Johnny Ives sort of palette color, orange for an Oompa Loompa. Although the pocketed shorts really are very comfortable and roomy, especially in the summer months. I'm saying if a contest winner is getting a tour of the Apple campus, and you happen to have cornered them in a dimly lit alley, you've got the dark suit, you've got the thick glasses, you're saying, "Congratulations, young boy. I will give you 10,000 American dollars if you can withdraw from the factory information about the following product. Remember this name, boy, and this money will be yours."
So what I'd say is that Steve Jobs was a much better businessman than Willy Wonka. And he would absolutely not take the contest winner.
Remember that Willy Wonka really knew how to control labor costs. He had a very fixed, targeted demographic. He had his own R&D, secretive R&D department.
I saw 13-year-old Oompa Loompas going through the gates at the Willy Wonka chocolate factory when I was in wherever his factory was. Yes, exactly. No, Jobs is not going to take people past the fizzy lifting drinks and the everlasting gobstoppers and the TV that makes you into a person in a TV set. He's Wonkavision. Thank you. He's not gonna do that. He's gonna take them to the cafe.
His own super secret TV set. The parallels are frightening.
Yeah, it is. Gene Munster put you up to that, I bet. So I don't know. I think that Steve Jobs, going to the mothership, going to the Cafe Max, walking around, introducing him to some people. I think having been to that, as I think John was, into that the radio testing lab with the anechoic chambers and all of that. I mean, that was the first time anybody from the public had been let in there, and I felt like the snipers were trained on us, and they were like black cloths over everything that might possibly be. And we were hardly industrial spies; we were a bunch of kind of shell shock journalists. Steve Jobs would not reveal the crown jewels to the winner he'd buy him some pasta at the cafe and call it a day. That's my prediction.
Plus, nobody would ever, ever get on the great glass elevator with Steve Jobs because it would be the
he would yell at them. Yeah,
he would yell at them
again. He liked to build with glass, no freestanding structures without any elements. Oh my God, we're peeling the onion here.
My problem with this story is that not that I don't believe it, because there's no reason to dispute Segal's writing on it, but the problem I have getting it into my head is that in my mind, Steve Jobs was one of the coolest guys who ever lived, and this does not sound cool at all. This sounds incredibly awkward and uncool. It's like finding out that Paul Newman had like a pair of pink slippers that every time he watched TV, he wouldn't turn it on unless he was wearing his fluffy pink slippers or something like that. Like, it just doesn't fit into my head of the. Of the way I conceived of Steve Jobs.
I think it was one of Steve's flashback days. I think it was just a regrettable thing went back to the 70s, and suddenly he went, I know. And he said, no, Steve, let's talk tomorrow. And the next day he said, oh, yeah, terrible idea. But going to your Slugworth point, in this case, I think that Slugworth, instead of actually secretly working for Jobs, actually was working for Microsoft. And the one thing that they wanted was the Pippin, because they thought maybe finally they would get on top of something and get ahead of the game. And that's actually what happened. And finally, the Xbox came out. So it shows you that every once in a while, these things pay off.
Rich, what do you think?
You know, I got stuck on the vision of Steve Jobs wearing Paul Newman's fuzzy pink slippers. And I never quite got over it. No, I can't see it happening. I could see having lunch with him and, you know, maybe an hour alone in the Apple company store, but no, not much more than that, really.
Andy, you know, I've known you for almost 20 years, and this is the most complex and bizarre hypothetical question I have ever heard come from you. So congratulations, sir.
I'm trying to keep you on your toes, gentlemen. Make sure you get your protein when you know you're going to be on a panel with me sometime later in the day.
The other thing, go ahead. Well, here's the thing is, if you got to meet Steve Jobs, wouldn't you be disappointed if it happened and he was wearing anything other than the black turtleneck, Levi's jeans, and New Balance 991s? Like, if he was wearing anything other than those things, you'd feel ripped off, let alone if he's dressed up as Willy Wonka.
Maybe it's just like a quick release outfit, like what strippers wear, and he'd pull it off and the black turtleneck would be underneath.
It's just, I don't know. Like, Dennis Leary tells the story about meeting Dean Martin. And so he's like really excited because Dean Martin, even like in his old age, was still the coolest guy in the world. He was still Dean Martin, and he's all excited about going to his house and meeting him for a drink. And Dean Martin answers the door, and Dennis Leary is disappointed because he's wearing a members only jacket. but then like 5 minutes later, I'm like, God, I want to get a members only jacket. That looks pretty cool on him. So we would all be shopping for, like, you know, pumpkin orange top hats after that first press photo of Steve Jobs in the Willy Wonka costume was released. Okay, well, I think we've cracked this. We've cracked the code on the Wonka / Apple singularity, and we're going to leave it for younger and more energetic and more LSD-fueled journalists to pursue. We're going to get to our tips of the week and our picks of the week, but before that, a shout out to our friends at audible.com. There are so many people who are really big, big fans of audiobooks. Podcasts are great. You're listening to one right now, hopefully. Each one of us could list 10 of them that we spend way, way too much of our free time listening to. But it's always so wonderful when you get a chance to read a full-length book from name brand and not so name brand authors, read by some really, really great voices. And Audible has tens of thousands of these books, no matter what topic you want, whether it's fiction, whether it's nonfiction, whether it's people that you like or people that your mom likes to read. You'll find titles there on audible.com. My pick for this week of a title that you can download and try for free is probably my favorite John Steinbeck book. Also, probably one of my favorite blogs ever. Unfortunately, he wrote this in 1962 before there was such a thing as ASCII text, and so he was forced to actually write it in the form of a book. It's called Travels with Charlie in Search of America, where Steinbeck, he was in his old age, he got into his head that he really wanted to buy an RV, load the RV with camping equipment, a couple of guns, and his dog Charlie, and just drive around the country revisiting all the places that he used to go to when he was a kid and sort of see how things had changed. He didn't really have a book in mind. He just wanted to, you know, enjoy a little vacation on his own, sleeping in the back of a truck that he named Rocinante, after Don Quixote's horse. Yes, as you can imagine, his wife and all of his friends said, yeah, you're going to be driving down the backwoods of the South, the Midwest, and the Northeast in a truck all by yourself. You are kind of an idiot, John. You're a very well-written idiot, but you're still kind of an idiot. But it's a book that is always on every single phone and every single ebook reader that I have, because every time I'm traveling, I usually dip into it and read another couple of chapters. I was reading it on the plane, as a matter of fact, yesterday on the way back from Ireland. And this book, as well as pretty much any other, can be yours for free if you go to audible.com/MacBreak to download your free book. We get a tip every single week, and we never, ever run out of great titles. There's millions of titles, figuratively speaking, in the backlist, and more to come every week. Now let's go into our tips of the week. Chris, you have an iOS tip for us.
I do. Sometimes one travels abroad, as both you and John had the opportunity to do this last week, to go to Ireland. Well, let's say that I'm going to be traveling abroad and have my iPad with me, and maybe I'm not going to have access to GPS or Wi-Fi or whatever expensive wireless plan there is abroad, and instead I'm going to be traveling to a city. So what I try to do then is I cache maps before I leave. So in this case, let's say I were going from Phoenix Park in Dublin, and I wanted to go to Trinity College afterwards. So I would pull up the Maps app while I have Wi-Fi access. So I'm at home or I'm at the airport. I pull that stuff up, and then once I've got my route selected, I click on List, and I can see the steps where I need to travel. So if I were making the walk from Phoenix Park to Trinity College, and then I do something really fairly analog, and I just take a screenshot of it. And so I find the 6 or 7 little trips that I intend to take while I'm in Dublin or wherever I happen to be traveling. I pull up the map so I can get a general idea of where I'm going to be walking. And then I pull up the list. And if the list is too long, you scroll it up and you take 2 screenshots. And then I cache those in my photo album so that later when I am wherever I am, I can pull up those spots. First of all, it reminds me that, oh, yes, I intended to do this. Secondly, it gives me the steps for doing exactly that. So it's pretty analog and it's pretty simple, but it's a good idea to take screenshots of things that you want to remember, particularly if you're going to need internet access or Wi-Fi access and you don't have it. And that's my iOS tip.
Yeah, the screen capture, if you've never used it, hold down the home button, press the power button at the same time, you'll hear a camera click. And it'll save the screen to your pictures folder. I use that all the time. What kind of sickens me is that especially when I'm traveling, I will do that to an email that has information that I absolutely need, because I've, from absolute sad and wearying experience, I know that my ability to use the iOS Mail app to search my existing inbox for an email from an address that I know for a fact to the letter it came from is pretty variable. If I really want to get that address later on, I'm really going to have to take a screen capture of that piece of email. And Jason, you've got our macOS pick of the week, don't you?
I do. I have a Mac tip. This is it's a feature in Lion, but I think that not a lot of people know about it, and I'm surprised how many people don't know about it. So, basically, when you're in the Finder, if you click in the search box and start typing, it will do a traditional Spotlight search. But which I'm going to do on my computer here, which I don't think you can see, so that's unfortunate. But if you wait, a little pop-up will come up, and it'll give you some options about how to define what you typed and what it means. And one of them is just the content. But you can also do something like file name. So if I'm searching for a JPEG with the name iTunes in it, I can choose file name, and I just click on the thing that says file name contains iTunes. And then I type JPEG, literally just the next thing in that search, and it'll pop up with an item that says file name contains JPEG or kinds JPEG image. And then I click on that, and it's building these little tiny chunks all stacked together in that Spotlight window that says, oh, look, there it is. That's my computer that says these things. And then it says search the desktop. I can search this Mac. And here come all the hits that are up there. It's searched by name and with a certain file type. This is really easy. It's much easier than the old method where you had to sort of type kind, colon, and JPEG and hope that worked. If you start typing something in, it'll try to guess, do you mean the name? Do you mean the contents? Do you mean a file type? So if you're looking for a Photoshop file with a certain word, you can do it very quickly. And then, of course, you can always click save to save that out permanently in your saved searches and get back to it later. But I think people don't know just how easy it is to do these more advanced searches in Lion in the Finder than you could do before. It's not just full text search of contents of your documents anymore. You can actually very quickly come in and search by name and by kind and stack them up and find exactly what you're looking for. So you should try it. I use it all the time. I use it much more than I use Spotlight search. I basically don't use Spotlight search in the Spotlight menu. It's very rare. I use the search in the Finder every single day.
Yeah. And isn't it cool to find out exactly how many different things you can search on? Whenever I'm trying to make a point about how good just the Spotlight engine is, I just do a demo where you can do a search for just the fireworks photos from the 4th of July just by simply saying that you shot with your iPhone. You can say, do a search for pictures shot with an iPhone on July 4 of any year that where the shutter speed was at least this and the time was after 6 p.m. And you can build that search and not only find those photos, but also save that as a smart folder. And any time that any sort of a supposed 4th of July fireworks photo lands on your computer, it'll land in the smart search folder. So thank you very much for that tip. Now let's move on to our picks of the week. And I haven't heard from Rich for a little while. So Rich, why don't we start off with you? I know you got a really good utility. I have this one myself and I've used it for the past 6 months. I'm sorry, for the past couple months at least.
I was introduced to this neat little trick by its developer. The application is called Dragon Drop, Dragon, Drop, one word. And what it does is it puts a little well on your screen. You can start dragging something, anything, text, a picture, anything you could drag from one application to the other. And you shake your mouse and it puts a little well on the screen. I see somebody playing the demo film there. And you drop it in there. And then you can go find your buried destination. Now, you might say, oh, well, I knew that I could switch applications while I was in the middle of a drag. But this really goes far beyond that. If the window that you want to drop into is buried, then switching applications doesn't help you. So the well is just extremely handy. It also supports pasting into the well, so you could copy and paste into the well, then go find your target and drop it in there as well. So it's very cleverly done, very nicely executed little product, and its usefulness goes far, far, far beyond the $4.99 asking price. He's got it. I approve of his choice of distribution methods. He's got it both in the Mac App Store and for direct sale. That's shinyplasticbag.com/dragondrop.
Yeah, I mean, there are those utilities that you install them, then you realize, why has this not been part of the OS since 10.4? This wasn't as important as getting, I don't know, print servers actually working on the operating system, but why is it so difficult to move data from one app to another when I have more than four windows on the screen at the same time? So, yes, that's a hearty endorsement from many places there. Chris, what's your pick?
I actually have two picks. Last week was Audubon's birthday, the bird guy. And if you watch birds at all, if you like tracking down birds, you have a copy of this. This is the Peterson Guide. And there are several bird books around, and people are using different ones like this. And National Geographic has one. One thing unique about the Peterson Guides is that they're all drawings instead of photographs. The tendency now is to go for photographs, but the traditionalists still carry Peterson. Well, birders rarely carry these books anymore. They don't need to because they have apps for all these things. So there are a couple of bird apps because of Audubon's birthday that were on sale, and one still is. The Peterson Guide is normally $20, and now it is just 99 cents on the App Store. So if you have any desire to go out and look at birds, it's a very handy guide. Oh, good. You can see it on the screen. So it has the same illustrations that they use in the Western and the Eastern bird guides, and this covers the U.S. and Canada. It also has a directory of bird calls. So unfortunately, nobody has yet come out with the Shazam for bird calls where you can hold up your phone, hear a bird call, and then have it identified. There actually is that. There is this technology, I've been told. But it's very expensive, and it's sold not in an iOS form. So we're hoping that somebody will get that eventually. So Peterson Guide is one. And then there's Audubon Birds, which is a field guide to North American birds. That was 99 cents last week. It's now up to $2.99, but still that's much less than the $20 it was before. The interface isn't as elegant as the Peterson Guide, but one thing about this that I love is that it works with location. And if you're a serious birder or even a medium to serious birder, one of the things that you want to know is what around me right now is rare. What bird near here shouldn't be here? For example, where I live near Santa Cruz, California, there are a pair of bald eagles nesting. We do not have bald eagles here ever. So this is a huge deal. So all you have to do is enter a search location, so Santa Cruz, for example, and it will tell where you are. And then you click on birds that have been spotted in your area, and it keeps a track of about the last 3 weeks. And in this case, it showed that there were indeed this pair of nesting bald eagles. It told you where they were sighted. So if you're a birder, then you go out and you can add to your life list. Speaking of life lists, both of these apps have life lists in them, which is I've seen a new bird, punch a button, and you can automatically document where you were, when you saw it, the time, and then you can add any notes you like. So again, this is much easier than carrying around that little scribbly notebook that birders used to carry around. Now it's just simply a tap. Here's where I was. This is the document. If you like, you can take a picture and then incorporate it into the app. Both of these are brilliant apps. There are two other bird apps that aren't on sale but are worth looking at. That's the Sibley Guide, which too is a book. And then there's iBird Pro, which has been around for several years now. Excellent apps. All four of them are excellent. And if you're a bird watcher, it's likely that you're going to carry more than one of these things around. So right now, the best bargain is the Peterson Guide and the Audubon Guide.
Excellent. Chris, are you a birder?
I am. I'm not a really good birder, but it's something because it works with geeks, and I'm sure there's some geeks listening out there who are going, oh, why bird watching? But what it does is it gives you an excuse to go outside and hunt for something without killing it. And for geeks, it's good because you're curious. You want to find something because you need to have some other reason to be outside instead of just being outside. So it really is a great occupation for people who are curious but need that motivation other than just getting exercise and getting some vitamin D.
Yeah, I know the feeling. I take my regular constitutionals, but mostly it's because I got this new pedometer gadget that hooks up via USB, and I just want to play the little games and get the idea that Andy, you'll get fresh air, you'll extend your lifespan, you'll control all these things are good. No, that's not a convincing enough argument. Yes, but if you get just 500 more steps, you'll get 2 more gold coins. You got me.
That's it,
Jason. What's your pick this week?
My pick is a game that I heard about on the internet. It's an iPhone and iPad game called Magnetic Billiards Blueprint. It's got this whole big website. It's by the Pickford Brothers. And you know what? It is really good. Sorry, I've just moved it. There it is. So it's a geometric game. It's very much like... the game it reminds me of is Orbital, which is one of the most addicting iOS games that I've ever seen. It is like billiards in that you have to make shots with these various colored balls that are on the screen, and you get points for banking them off the wall and for getting near but not touching balls of different colors before hitting the same colored balls. And then they form geometric shapes. They adhere together, and you get bonus points for various things. And it's a great way to pass the time. It's shocking. One of the terrible mistakes is giving you a Game Center reward for playing the game for an hour, because you go, what? That was an hour? And it's quite disturbing to discover that. But it is a lot of fun. I've been playing it for the last few weeks, and it's a little quirky. It's got a lot of synthesized voice sound effects, and it tells you things like "cool shot" with these robot voices, and the authors of the game pop up at various points to tell you things. So it's definitely got a kind of quirky handmade feel to it, but at its core, it is this really cool geometric. You know, it's all about angles and the amount of spin or the amount of power you put into your shot, and you can make some really terrible shots. And over time, you learn to make these really precise, great shots. So it's not even though it's called billiards, it's really not so much a billiards game as it is a strange kind of geometry and physics game for iOS that if you ever played Orbital, and if you haven't, you should look for Orbital too, because it's fantastic as well. It's in that vein. You can just play it forever. So Magnetic Billiards, and I think it's free, and then for some extra levels there are in-app purchases, but you can play for well over an hour, let me tell you, without making any in-app purchases.
Yeah, that sounds like exactly my kind of game, because I had to kind of quit using Orbital because I found myself every time I had more than 20 seconds worth of idle time, I would be like getting out Orbital to see if I can like get at least one game going. And I realized that I was not at any point during the day, I was never giving my brain even 1 minute to shut down because I was filling all of my downtime with Orbital, and I felt as though that was medically contradicted.
Yeah, it's a dangerous game, but it's great. So if you want to throw your life away, Orbital is the game for you. Try it out, and then Magnetic Billiards Blueprint.
Spoken like a dad. If you want to throw your life away with those damn
computer
games, go ahead.
The video games.
I can't stop you.
You can break your computer with those.
John, what's your pick?
My pick is an iPhone app called Screenshot Journal. So it sort of ties in nicely with Chris's tip from earlier. And it's an app by UiForge, which means it's designed by my friend Brian Bell, also a mutual friend and of Rich. He's done some icon design for Bare Bones, and Jacob White, who did the programming. And it's a very simple app. It is for people, for UI designers. I use it as a beta tester for iOS apps. And all you do, it looks through your camera library. It finds the images in your camera library that are screenshots, and it separates them from your main library of photos. Just shows you your screenshots. It lets you open them up and zoom in with pixel precision. And the big thing to understand is that, why not just use the camera app, which lets you zoom in a little? Number one, Screenshot Journal lets you zoom in way more. And number two, the big thing, if you're talking about nitpicking literally just pixel level details, when you zoom in this app, it just makes the pixels bigger and it looks real, real pixely and blocky, which is exactly what you want. Whereas the built-in camera app does something which is the right thing in most cases for most people, which is when you zoom in, it kind of blurs everything to try to keep it looking more aesthetically pleasing, like when you zoom in on a photo. Which is exactly not what you want when you want to argue about pixel level precision of UI graphics. It is, however, I must warn you, it is an extremely expensive app. You are probably going to have to take out a second mortgage on your home to afford it. It costs $1.99.
Damn it!
That's outrageous.
Forget it.
Clearly,
I will vouch for that app as well. It's an excellent little product, and I have been, am, and will remain a fan of Brian's work because he's a very talented designer.
It is a very simple idea, and the fact that Brian is a terrific designer means that the app itself, even though it's meant for you to use to examine your own UI designs, the app itself has a very, very pleasant, simple, obvious, but very, very aesthetically pleasing design. It's a great little app.
One star. Why does this cost $1.99? This should be free.
Did you write that in all caps? Because that's mandatory when you give it a review like that.
No. I was using all kinds of international characters. The Arabic characters let you do like fake smileys and stuff. I believe my message will have been sent. My own pick of the week is a really cool camera app that I was told about during the trip. As a matter of fact, I have yet to find a camera app that I really, really like. I find a lot of different apps that have a little bit of what I want in a camera app. Chiefly, what I want is an app that doesn't accidentally start taking video when I meant for it to start shooting pictures. So if you can just do that, then I think that you're well on your way. This is 645 Pro by Jagger, JAG.GR is the URL. It's also, of course, in the App Store. Tries to emulate a professional level camera. And so you get this really, really cool, like, professional level camera interface. You've got like two wheels on the side here for selecting what film format you want. You've got another wheel for to select aspect ratios. But it has two or three big features that make it unique and that I really, really like. Number one, there is this fake LCD panel on the bottom that shows you, just like on a regular camera, here's the shutter speed that it's about to select. Here's the histogram, that live histogram of here's what value is it seeing. It allows you to really see the picture before it gets taken and spot the problems that happen before they happen. Oftentimes, I'll take a picture with my iPhone and realize that, damn, it didn't expose it properly. There's all kinds of blowouts in places that are really, really important. You can check the histogram this way and figure it out that way. The second feature of it is just it does a much, much better job of like spot exposure and spot metering. There is my friend Batman who watches over me and is prepared to punish Skype for all the evil that it does, the cowardly superstitious app. I don't know if you can see in the corner there. On the iOS in the standard iOS camera app, you can tap to set the exposure, but the hot zone is way, way too big. You can't get a nice precise sample of just this one area. And secondly, you have to, while you're holding this camera, this slick, shiny, like not holdable thing in your hands, you have to sort of move your thumb over to sort of make sure you highlight it, then get it back to get to the camera thing. But this one, it's just a small spot that's right in the middle of the crosshairs. So all you have to do is just aim it where you want to go, tap the auto expose, a dedicated auto exposure lock button. Then you can move it to another place, tap the dedicated auto focus lock button. And then both of those things are locked in. So now you can keep just taking pictures. That's the reason why that picture of you, John, giving the talk with that big, big spotlight in your face, it was just impossible for me to shoot with the iPhone because auto exposure just could not handle it. And then every time like I moved or you moved, it would just lose the spot. This was so much easier to shoot. The other cool feature is that it can also save not only in the standard JPEG, but also JPEG plus an uncompressed TIFF. So if you have ever been concerned about, you've dumped your photos and you realize that, oh God, these are way too jaggy, oh, there's too many compression artifacts, if you shoot with this one, you will not only get a standard JPEG in your master camera roll, but once you connect it to iTunes via USB, you will be able to remove from the app via the standard document transfer feature a TIFF version that's uncompressed and ideally much, much better quality than what you're getting off of a JPEG. I've had a couple of days to play around with it and do a bunch of side-by-side comparisons. Unfortunately, it's not quite as good as you might hope. It's not the equivalent of having a camera that can shoot RAW, for instance. But there are many instances in which, yeah, you can really notice an improvement between this TIFF version and the JPEG that the camera app would have shot. And it's fairly cheap. It's $2.99. So basically $1 more than the already grossly overvalued screen capture utility. But it's pretty good as it is. As usual, I'm still waiting for that one app to rule them all. That one camera app that fixes everything for me. Until then, it looks like I'm going to be stuck having four different apps that I switch between depending on what I'm after at any given moment. Is anybody happy with the camera app? Anybody willing to defend it here? Jason,
anybody here.
I got during my talk my talk at the conference. I mean, there were like 120 people in the room. I said, everybody, raise your hands if you have a video file on your iPhone right now that's shorter than 2 seconds in duration. Every single hand went up. So I honestly think that we should almost set a timer now that that Apple has a maximum number of days in which to fix that problem before we just say somebody doesn't deserve whatever lunch that they're getting for free at any point in their days as an employee. Well, that's all the topics that we were going to go through. That's also some great picks, some great tips. And the only thing that's left is to go around the corner and thank all these wonderful people for their wit, their intelligence, their insight, and their generosity for dealing with a host via Skype that Skype just simply seems to hate with a passion of 1,000 burning suns. Jason, what would you like to plug? You have so many editorial projects going on. Who can pick just one?
Yeah, I'm going to pick, we actually launched a brand new site called TechHive at TechHive, TechHive.com. It is from the editors of Macworld and PC World, and it is a beta site. The full site will launch this summer, and it's a place for us to talk about things that aren't Macs and aren't PCs. So there's a game story up there now, a thing about Android, some iOS stuff, a lot of fun. We're getting a movie critic to write a twice a month feature about great movies that are coming on and off Netflix streaming. Lots of good stuff that we're going to try out there in the next few months. That's the big editorial project right now at Macworld and PC World. So check it out, TechHive.
Another addition to the massive Jason Snell constellation of online.
Yes, my brand portfolio.
John, we always will. You know, we can see a daring fireball. The coolest thing was being at the reception at this big house, not knowing we're about to be visited by the Lord Mayor of Dublin, and he introduces himself to you, and as soon as he finds out who you are, John Gruber, I read Daring Fireball every night for 10 minutes, and I found out about this conference because I read your blog. Oh my God, you're so awesome. It's not only tech influence, but it's political influence as well. So I'm looking forward to bowing down before the ever expanding Daring Fireball Empire.
I have to say, I was very surprised by that. I mean, I was already extremely excited to be there. It's a beautiful mansion. I mean, I had no idea. Here we are meeting the Lord Mayor. The best part is you come in the door and the butler in the Lord Mayor's mansion in Dublin, asks if you need anything and asks if you want a pint of Guinness. And you go, yes, of course. And then 30 seconds
there's
later...
There's only one right answer to that question.
30 seconds later, you're in the mansion. The Lord Mayor's butler comes over with a fresh pint of draft Guinness. And everybody says, it's just one of those things, but it is absolutely true, is that in Dublin, the Guinness is incredibly... good. I mean, it's so much better. It's a fine beer anywhere in the world, but in Dublin, it's unbelievable. It is sort of like the difference between sugar Coke and high fructose corn syrup Coke. It is like, this is the real thing. And there I am enjoying the Guinness, and the Lord Mayor comes up and says he found out about the conference on my website. I was like, maybe I should just move here.
That was pretty awesome. Yes, and it's also absolutely true, like what you're saying about the Guinness, because I'm not a beer drinker. I'm almost sure that people think that I'm either an alcoholic or just some sort of Puritan by the number of times they've seen me in a place where everybody is drinking and I'm not drinking. But it's like, well, I just don't happen to drink that often. So it's, well, I'm in Ireland. I have to at least sample a Guinness, expecting like, just with every other beer I've ever tried, I'll have a couple sips. Oh, that's tasty. A couple more sips, then put the half glass back down and walk away from it again. On Sunday alone, I had 3 pints of Guinness. I drank more Guinness.
It's like drinking water. Come on.
Yeah.
In Ireland.
It's really incredible. The whole thing, it's a beautiful city. The conference was great. The Lord Mayor it was a privilege and an honor to meet him. But I kind of can't stop shutting up about how good the Guinness was. It was like mind blowing.
and unfortunately, I people are asking me, I'm meeting up with friends like tonight and for the rest of the week. And of course, oh, how was Ireland? And I have to I remember that there's an article in The Onion about this guy who wouldn't shut up about how good the Guinness was in Ireland and how they don't make it properly over here. And I have to put on that little separate egg timer in my head that said, when you talk about how good the Guinness is, get it down to 8 seconds and says, oh, it was really, really good. I was drinking it all the time. And you know me, I don't drink that much. And then change the subject or else you'll become that guy who says, well, of course, you really can't have a proper pint unless you're in Ireland. Ideally in this little out of the way pub outside of the tourist area that I found on my second day. Yes, but Guinness, but believe what they say, it really is. The Book of Kells, also a really good national treasure of Ireland. We both saw the Book of Kells, but if I could only rescue one thing out of Ireland before the aliens wipe it from the face of the earth, that's not going to happen. But let's say it were to happen, it's either the whatever it is that gives us the ability to keep making Guinness or the Book of Kells. Sorry, that's why we have ebooks, guys.
Yeah.
Chris, where can we find you?
Well, apparently you're going to find me at the Guinness factory next opportunity I have. I've actually been to Dublin once, and I have been to the factory. And you take your tour and you get your 2 pints at the end of the tour. And even if you do it at 9 a.m., and generally I'm not sort of a 9:20 a.m. drinker, but you have to when you're there because it's just that good. And it would be, it's insulting to the natives. And I have an Irish last name, and so therefore I feel like I need to do that. Otherwise, you can find me at macworld.com, and I have a number of training videos at lynda.com. So check out both. Oh, and I'm gonna have my first piece on TechHive later this week. Woo-hoo! So take a look at that, too.
Can you give us a little teaser, or you're under NDA?
I'll have to ask my boss. Boss, can I give a little teaser?
Sure, go ahead. Also, everybody who comes to TechHive will be offered a pint of Guinness. So
really?
No, not really.
By Jason Snell's butler.
Yes.
The piece is an exhaustive look at music subscription services. So I'm comparing Spotify and Rhapsody and Moog and Slacker and Ardia. So which is the best deal and whether you're a good candidate for these kinds of services.
Excellent. And Rich, where can we find you and where can we download BB Edit from? Both places or just one place now?
You can find me and my products at barebones.com. We have BB Edit up there. We have Tech Strangler up there. Just released a major new version of that. And last but absolutely not least, Yojimbo. And also, I've been told that I need to plug another product, the famous Blue Norwegian brand Birdie Nibs.
Ah, yes.
Preferred by 9 out of 10 right-thinking parrots, apparently.
Ah, yes. They vote with their talons on how much they love and want the Blue Norwegian Birdie Nibs. Is that not true?
Yes, they do. That is absolutely true. So, barebones.com it is.
Excellent. I'm Andy Notko. You can find me at the Chicago Sun-Times, suntimes.com. If you can spell my last name, you can also find my blog at anotko.com. If you cannot spell my last name, which is far more likely, just type cwob.com for my celestial waste of bandwidth, and you'll find an internet pipeline that'll take you exactly to that exact same place. Thanks to everybody for taking part in this special show. For everybody who's listening, Mac Break is broken done. Now get back to work, you gold bricks. You got time to lean. You got time to clean.